Hi, and welcome to Curious Conversations, the podcast where curiosity meets connection. Thanks for joining as we discuss captivating stories and ideas and engage in thought-provoking conversations with experts, enthusiasts, and everyday people. We hope to ignite a curious spirit as we embark on a quest for understanding one curious conversation at a time. So let's jump in this together. Welcome to the world of Curious Conversations. And welcome to Curious Conversations. We are your hosts, Carly and Mandy, and this week we are talking about Brain Injury Awareness Month.
Yes, which is March. And I did a little research on this topic and discovered that someone in the United States sustains a brain injury every 9 seconds. That was alarming.
Yeah, I know. You know, according to the Brain Injury Association of America, there are more than 5.3 million individuals in the U.S. living with a permanent brain injury-related disability.
Wow, that number is alarming. I know today we have an interview you did with Tiffany Garrigan, who falls into that category, though.
Yeah, we do. You know, but before we dive in, I do think we should share this week's curious dish. So this is part of the show where we dish about the most curious thing we've seen this week. So Mandy, what you got for us?
Okay, so this will bring a little humor to a heavy, before the heavy subject. But all right, you know the old woman who lived in a shoe, you know that little nursery rhyme thing?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so this week I saw that there really is a shoe you can stay in.
What?
Yeah. Okay. So my cousin's a real estate agent and he always does these little funny posts, you know, he's got to keep people interested. And so there was this shoe and I'm thinking, this is a joke, but it looks like a legitimate shoe you could go to. So I look it up, wondering if it's real. And it was, it's in Pennsylvania.
Really? Okay. So when I think about the little old lady who lived in a shoe, I'm like going back through my grandmother's old books. And I think of like a big kind of like a dirty lace up work boot with like kids climbing out of the windows that are actually like the shoelace holes, assuming that this one is much nicer.
Yeah, no, it's like Airbnb or something. It's a concrete shoe. And then when you look at the inside, you'll have to look this thing up. You look inside and it's all, you know, laid out really cute. And then outside they have a fire pit. It kind of looks like it's just dumped on the side of the road, though. It's a little bit bizarre, but nice.
I love it. Okay, I'm going to look that up for sure. Yep. And I'm going to follow your theme on this one for mine. I'm going to throw us way back, like, I'm going to say late 90s. Mm-hmm. I decorated my first house with furniture that was like as fancy as like I could afford. I went to like a local store and got a little line of credit and I bought everything I could find that was gold and black. So like couch, chaise lounger, everything black and gold. Cause that meant like I had made it. It was fancy. I bought the most amazing chair. And it totally fit in with my decor because it was that black and gold color, but it was shaped like the most majestic stiletto you could ever find. Like you literally sat in the heel of the shoe. I loved it. I called it my fancy high heel chair.
Okay. I love that because back in the day, I know the 90s, I know that decor, and there was a shoe and like I coveted this shoe. It was red with, leopard print. And it was the shoe chair, you know, and I would look, it was at, I forget what mall it was, like outside of Bughead or something. And I would look through that window and it just seemed like, well, you've made it now if you had that chair. And I didn't get the chair. So you probably got my chair is what happened.
Oh, we're going to have to go find those chairs. We need them.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I don't know if I would have that now, but I don't know where I would put that.
Right.
But,
me too.
Yeah, if we had like a little studio or something, I could totally see having those shares. That would be great. Oh my gosh. So this week's episode really hits home for me. You know, I had an aunt who I'm really close to. And she went into the hospital with some symptoms that looked like a severe brain issue. And she had confusion, altered state, hallucinations. And we thought something was going on there, like that. But I'll tell you more about that afterward. And first, I want to hear Tiffany's story. I'm really interested to see if there's any relation in symptoms to what she had.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do know a little bit about your story with your aunt, but I'm very anxious to hear more about that. You know, with Tiffany, I originally met Tiffany because she's a writer. So we all kind of have that in common. She's actually a brilliant young lady. She has a very powerful story, and she's just really had to overcome so much. But I don't really want to go too far into it because she tells it so well. So I think we just jump right into that interview. Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us today. We're excited to have you on, and we're excited to hear your story. I have had the privilege of reading your book and speaking with you about this. And so I'm kind of privy to a lot of it. And I know it's great. It's a story of triumph and perseverance. And we're just really excited to share it. So I think let's just start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about you? What you got going on?
Well, my name is Tiffany. I'm from Calhoun, Georgia, born and raised. I'm 37. I'm an author and a life coach, former paralegal, love the legal field, but things just changed there. So I'm building my public speaking foundation. So I've been getting into some of that and teaching small groups at church and things like that at the moment.
Oh, so, okay, you're doing some stuff with public speaking. Have you always been into that, or was there ever a point where that just made you really nervous?
I haven't always been into it, but I remember my public speaking class in college. I was so nervous. I don't know why I was so nervous. I mean, I did well in it, but it was just scary. But I can speak in front of people I know much easier than I can in like in front of big crowds. But I've gotten better with it. But I know I do try to write down what I'm going to say, or an outline at least, so I don't get too fidgety.
Okay, that was going to be my next question. Are you like a pantser or a plotter? Do you fill out an outline? So I'm kind of the opposite. I am good to speak in front of a room full of strangers, but you start putting people in there that I know, and you know, I tend to make it a conversation, and I'll look at one person, and you know, so do you make eye contact when you speak, or are you looking over the crowd?
Well, when I first start to speak, I make eye contact. But sometimes, yeah, depending on who I'm looking at, the eye contact can be a distraction.
Yep.
So I kind of look like out to people maybe I don't know well or haven't seen, or I look out but not up to where I can't see anybody.
Yep, that's it. That's it. I look right above everyone's head. Well, listen, you talked about college. Tell us about your college experience and your degree.
Well, I have a bachelor's degree in political science, but I started out as a nursing major, then to education. I went through a few different majors before I found what I actually liked. So when I started taking political science and government classes in my minor for my electives, that's when I knew that I was interested in like actually reading for leisure, reading to learn, and writing. That's when I really found out I like to write in more in depth in college.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I love to write. Obviously, you love to write. That's something we have in common.
Yeah.
So you enjoyed writing in college too?
I did. That's when I first realized that I liked writing, and I definitely liked research. That's when I first figured that out.
Yeah. You know, some people really just like the creative writing side of it. And then there are those that enjoy that, the research stage of it and really digging in. And I think that's so important when you're writing even fiction. You know, you've got to be well researched in what you're presenting. So that's definitely a good skill to have. But I've not heard a lot of people say, oh, I loved writing in college. You know, those college papers can be daunting.
Well, they can be. And I would say that I liked writing when I found my major.
Yes.
I think that's when I really realized that I like writing and researching and talking about those things, when I actually found what I like to do.
Okay. So, all right. Where'd you go to school? Is local?
University of West Georgia.
Okay. All right. So Tiffany, you then graduate, you have a degree. What was next for you?
I took on a job at a law firm in Cartersville, Georgia, and I really liked it there. And I was there for a few years, and then from there, I went to Kennesaw State, got a paralegal certificate in Georgia law, and then that's when I took on a job in the legal field, in the legal medical field in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what did you do there exactly? What does that entail?
In Sandy Springs, I was mainly in the medical legal department in Medicare, Medicaid. It was an interesting area of the law, something I didn't really know existed when I got to that part of my legal career. So I learned a lot there.
That's awesome. Okay. So you're not there anymore, obviously. Something happened, and you and I both know, but I definitely want to share with our listeners, you had something that happened one day, and you found yourself in the hospital, completely changed for life. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, I went to work every I lived in Kennesaw at the time, so I went to work every day. And I always say I drove 75 south to 285 east, obviously very, very busy areas. I did that drive every
Right.
morning and evening. But that day I went to work, got there, I felt fine, obviously, because I'd driven that 75 to 285 route. And I was there, I don't know what time of day, what happened, and I honestly don't remember that day. I just know that I learned that I wasn't feeling good. I didn't look like myself. I wanted to go home, but my coworkers wouldn't let me. And that's when they called 911 and the ambulance came, got me, and I went to Northside Hospital in the ambulance.
So, gosh, yeah, you're at work and you're feeling okay. And then you want to leave, but your coworkers know better than to let you leave and get into a vehicle. Is that kind of what happened?
Yes, I
Wow.
was feeling okay, but not okay enough to where they noticed something. I wanted to go home. They wouldn't let me.
Wow. So did they share with you the signs that they saw? What were their red flags?
I just learned that eventually after I got better down the road that they say I wasn't myself. And me, like, I knew
Really?
everybody, and the office was a big place. I knew everybody. I talked to everybody every day. So they probably seen that I wasn't my regular. I guess my regular personality. I mean, because I don't remember the day.
Wow.
They knew something was
Okay.
different.
Yeah. So they call an ambulance, they come and get you, and now you're in the hospital. Do you remember anything about that first evening in the hospital?
No, I don't remember the ride to the hospital or the first night or the first few weeks.
Really? Wow. So tell us a little bit about when you started to remember and having to come back around and figure out where you were and what had happened. I'm assuming you had a lot of family, with you.
Well, when I realized where I was and what happened, I wasn't in Northside Hospital anymore. But when I was in Northside Hospital, I was put on life support and given 2 hours to live and found out I had blood clots in my legs and lungs. And that's what essentially began the injury. So a little while after that, I went to Floyd Hospital in Rome, and that's when I realized that I'd been in the hospital. I didn't know where I was, what happened. I woke up, I found out I was blind. I couldn't move. Things were just completely different. And I just wondered, like, what in the world happened? What's going on? And I re finally remember, like, okay, what really happened to me? And I didn't know the state I was in until I was actually starting to, like, come around a little bit.
Wow, so you started to come to and you could not see, you could
No.
not move. Wow. So did you have, you obviously someone tried to explain to you maybe what was going on, or was it easy for you to comprehend, or did it become easier for you to comprehend?
Eventually, like over time, it became more simple to comprehend, but it took a while to comprehend it though. When my mind started to come to, and I was in inpatient therapy in Rome, I just remember having to be like rolled over in bed, picked up out of bed, getting help getting dressed, put into a wheelchair, using like arm bikes to move my arms and things like that. I couldn't get in, having to get dressed by the nurses and my mom. They had to fix my hair. I had a feeding tube for a while, everything.
Oh, so do you know how long you were in the hospital in Rome?
Not right off the top of my head, but I know I did spend some time there.
Gotcha. So from there, when did your sight return? You can see now.
Yes, I can see now.
Yeah, and you're
It
walking.
my sight, it began to return in Rome, but it was very, very, very thick. And what I say is it was like looking through wax paper. It's like, you can see like sense light, but nothing else. And that's one of the things that I first noticed is that I could sense light, but I couldn't see anything else.
Wow. So your sight, was that the first thing to really start to come back to you?
You know what? I really don't know, Carly. My sight, and I was talking and thinking, but my body hadn't put all those things back together yet. So I was
Wow.
talking, comprehending, communicating eventually, because I had to learn how to talk again too. But I don't know that my brain and my body had all become on the same page yet.
So tell us about that journey to recovery, and I know that took a long time, and there were a lot of people involved, a lot of therapies involved. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the journey to recovery was very, very, very long, and I just nothing like nothing I'd ever been through, really. The first part of my therapy started in Atlanta, the stage of my injury that I don't remember. I just remember learning about, doing therapy from bed and picking up my legs and things like that. But I just didn't get all my strength back till some while, a lot later. But when I was in Rome, I was stronger, so they would get me out of the bed. I eventually had a therapist walk like behind me, and like my legs were moving, their legs moved. I used a wheelchair all the time. I did the hand bicycle thing. I had to do vision therapy. I didn't even know there was such thing as vision therapy. I did occupational therapy, physical therapy, everything. I had a feeding tube. It was interesting once I started to realize like what I had been through and where I was at. So I always say it's like a science project, or I'm like a science project.
Yes. That's unfortunate though.
Yeah, an
So
unfortunate science project, but I like glad it came out on the better side.
Wow. So tell me then, now do you still have, well, what was your final diagnosis?
Blood clots, a pulmonary embolism that went to my lungs from my legs, and those clots there caused an anoxic brain injury. For sure, my brain getting a lack of oxygen and blood flow to function.
And do you suffer from any residual effects from that, or was it just a complete recovery? Do you still suffer some?
Yeah, I still have like some fatigue that just lingers from the injury. I have some short-term memory issues, but now I've used a lot of like my phone and a lot of notebooks and things like that. And that's one of the things that I learned in therapy was how to work around things that you lost or things that may or may not come back, or how to have that second and third option, maybe a fourth option if you need it.
Oh, I love that. So you have written a book about your experience. Can you tell us about the book in general, but also the writing process? And was that something that was difficult for you to kind of relive and to hash out?
Well, the writing process was difficult for a lot of reasons. First, being that I had to actually learn how to physically write and type again. Then, two, because I went blind also. But then, at the point I wrote my book, my vision had cleared up to 20/20, and I began wearing glasses. But also, like thinking and putting things together, like the cognitive skills, I lost all that too, and I had to like relearn how to think again. And that doesn't always make sense when I tell people, but I really had to. Like, learn how to learn again. So I'm sitting
Wow.
here, like this 25, 26, 27, and up year old woman, like a college graduate and a law firm employee. And then here I am writing simple words like cat and dog and coloring and tracing lines again. So even I realize now, you learn stuff like when you're born and as you through life easy, but relearning again, I kind of realized like how difficult it was. But there's to some point it comes natural. But then at that time, it wasn't really natural. Again, I had to relearn it.
Wow.
But
So
so as
what's
far as writing the book, that part of the process, I finally decided I wanted to write a book like officially, officially. after I was in therapy again, and that's when I was learning how to ways to think and like memorize things or strengthen my memory in certain areas, or even understanding what I'm reading. And that's when I really realized, okay, I'm gonna write a book.
Good for you. That's awesome. Well, what's the title of your book?
The title is Lifeline, A Devotional Journey. It's a devotional about what I went through. And I honestly, Carly, I don't know how the devotional idea came up because I was writing a book that was gonna be like this novel kind of storybook. And I just could never like get it right. So I stopped writing, well, writing the book for a while anyway. And I just kind of set it to the side and, worked on the other like rehabilitation things. And
Yep.
eventually it just came to me like, maybe we'll try it like this. And that's how the devotional idea came up.
Well, that is fantastic. And it is a great book. I actually have given away some copies. You gave me some
Hey.
copies that, we've given away. And it's just been quite a journey for you. I do see you talking about your book and giving those out all the time. So I'm really proud of you. I mean, just to jump back into it, and not just accept things for the way they were. You kind of went out, just above and beyond and said, "Hey, I'm going to set a goal and I'm going to make it happen." And you did make it happen. And now you've got a beautiful book, that tells your story. But what are you doing now?
Well, now I am starting to speak more. I get really, really nervous. I really don't know why, but that's just where I am. I started a blog. It's an empowerment blog for anybody who, needs empowerment, encouragement, or just, likes the funny ideas or things that I may do, where then I also get ideas from other people or other, stories that I see around. And I've been teaching Sunday school at church.
Awesome. Well, now tell us what your blog is called.
It's called Peace and Grace. The website is www.peacegracelife.com.
I love it. And then you're teaching at Sunday school. And I know you're also, are you a life coach?
Yes, I am a life coach. I mainly coach teens and women, or teen girls and women. And also, one of the things that I like in there is that I coach also people with disabilities, meaning
Oh,
people
I
with
love that.
brain injuries, maybe like mental health issues, or mainly a lot of self-esteem issues. So it doesn't have to be a disability per se. It's more like an empowerment coaching.
I love it. That's fantastic. So, people who are interested in your book, where can they purchase that?
They can purchase it on Amazon, Lifeline, A Devotional Journey, or you can just type in Tiffany Garrigan. And if you're in Calhoun, it's also at the Lighthouse Christian Bookstore.
I love it. Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for sharing your story. I know it's going to be encouraging to someone else, so I really appreciate that you're willing to talk about it.
What a story. I mean, she's really been through a lot. I knew some of this, but I just can't imagine. I love it when people are open about their story and what they've gone through, and they just let others into that. They're just raw with what they've been through, because you never know how that's going to impact someone else.
Yeah, definitely. Tiffany has a long road to recovery, and she still has things to work through as she like finds her new normal. And that just makes me really curious about your aunt. Were there similarities in their stories?
So my aunt's story is different, but you really have to get the idea of the full picture on this one, because it was roller coaster diagnosis, really. So I'll just start at the beginning. Okay, so I got a call out of the blue. Thought everything was going fine with her. She lives alone, so she doesn't see someone every day. She doesn't even talk to, everybody in the family every day. She's very self-sufficient. She's very independent. And even though she's getting a little bit older, she's not had any kind of problem that, like with her mind or anything like that.
Yeah, right. She's
So,
very, very on it.
right. Yeah.
She's a
You know
firecracker.
her. Yeah. So I get a call, and what I thought was out of the blue, a neighbor had found her, and she was incoherent, and she was confused and wasn't really responsive. And, of course, so they had nothing to go on. They didn't know what had happened. So I said, we need to call an ambulance, and I couldn't get there right at that moment. So I was like, we've got to get some help out there, because I tried to talk to her on the phone and wasn't really getting anywhere. So mm-hmm. in my head, I've got this picture. Hey, something requires, emergency care. So I end up on the scene, and she is very out of it. And the ambulance comes, and they're trying to take everything into account and grab information from us that we don't have because we haven't seen her immediately. The shorter version, because this went on for a few months, she gets to the hospital. They're doing all these tests, trying to figure out what's going on. They do find that she has COVID. And so it's my understanding that they gave her medication for that, a medication that was not readily available when we looked into it in the area that she lived in. So this was, sure. I don't know if we want to say experimental, and I know that's a little sensitive, but that was my understanding. Now, I say it was my understanding because even though I was the emergency contact, I did not have the power to have her medical resources and information and all that given to me over the phone. So that's right. Where it got a little tricky. So they're doing all these tests. They're trying to figure out what's going on with her. And my other aunt and myself are the closest relatives. And we're not able to get a full picture of this because we don't have power of attorney over that particular thing. So you start learning really quickly where your power lies and where you don't have any power in a situation like this, which is a little bit scary and something to certainly take into consideration. Because you never know when you're going to be in a place like this. She needs somebody as her advocate, and we're trying to do that. Of course, they've got her in an isolated room because of COVID. This was more, they were taking it more seriously at the time in terms of the rules and regulations.
Right.
So they keep her. We're talking off and on to her, but she doesn't have a phone in her room. So we're kind of going through the nurse's station and just getting those bits and pieces of information that you get when you're changing staff. The doctors are changing out. The hospitalists are changing out so many days, and nurses are changing over. But what we're gathering is that she had COVID, so she could have had confusion. She could have not been responsive because of that. And her numbers were off, like perhaps she's had some kidney stuff, and all these things kind of working together had made her off. So we're thinking, okay, here we go. They decide to release her after a week, and I went to pick her up. And I get her outside, and as soon as she's out there, I can see something's really off. And that's where the downward spiral starts.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was alarming because you're thinking, even though I haven't seen her, I've been in conversations with them, the staff and all, and you've got this picture of what's going on. So she didn't know what to do with the seatbelt. And when she got in the car. And so a week or so ago, she'd been driving, always drove. She's retired, but she, she drove and all. So she didn't know what to do with the seatbelt. So in my mind, I'm like, okay, just don't act like this is weird. And so I'm helping her out. Then she starts talking 90 miles an hour. It's not a confusion like slow, delayed. It's like really sort of wacky, the things that she comes up with on the way home. So I'm thinking in the back of my head, what's going on? What's going on? She's not acting like herself. I'm wondering, did they give her a medicine? Did she show this to them and they let her go home anyway? What's going on here? But there's obviously all mental things. I'm not seeing that physically she's not acting sick. This all feels brain related. And I'm thinking, what happened to my aunt that I'm really close to? By the time we get that, I'm supposed to be dropping off, mind you, at her house to leave alone, because I think she's just coming home after recovering from COVID. We get to her road that she's lived at 30 something years. And she leans onto my leg and laughs and says, I got to tell you, I have no idea where we are. And I thought, wow. Oh my gosh, what in the world? And she and I have talked about this since, but, so I'm thinking, oh, please come back to my aunt, on the right, just down her road. I'm like, saying all this little chitter chatter, like, oh, don't you know this? Of course you know this. And you're thinking, who am I talking to? I get her home and, you know, stay with her, get her settled, and then start arranging for the process of who's going to be around her, what are we going to do, this sort of thing. So from there on out, the next couple of months are just a very scary train wreck, really. What happens is she seemed to get a little better. And then my aunt and uncle, who were living in another state at the time, they come to stay with her and she stops sleeping. My aunt literally stops sleeping. She's going around the clock. And it's just like this sort of wild manic episode. And it was very strange. And I'm thinking, well, she's not weak from sickness. You know, she's not, you know, her thoughts are not delayed, but they were not natural thoughts. So she's taken a shower in the middle of the night. Then she's taken another shower. Then I find out she's taken the phone cords of my aunt and uncle and buried them in a flower pot outside. So she's sneaking out through the back door. They're trying to sleep. They're trying to keep up with her. It's just like, you know, like the four alarm fire kind of thing going on. And they're just on damage control. She's all over the place. She won't be still. She says things that you think, why are you saying that? So they call family over. You know, we go over some more, my family, my brother, and different people go over, and we're trying to assess the situation. And she has these bouts for a moment where she's angry and like slaps out. And she's just like, you flipped a switch and it's not the person I know.
You know, this sounds so similar to, you know, my grandmother had Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was definitely over a greater span of time. And I'm talking years and years between seeing her kind of doing some things that were off and what in the world is happening right now. But that wasn't the case for your aunt. It was like flipping a switch. I can't imagine.
Yep. It was flipping a switch. So we're standing there watching this. You know, you're not used to like getting on to your elder aunt right. in the family. It's like a very bizarre feeling. And we're all kind of like watching this happen, like you know, turned on the TV. And I remember my brother said she's going outside. And I go out on the back porch where she often goes normally, like to smoke. That's like her little section. She's done that for years. I go out there and she's got a, you know, the little pin cushion, like the old fashioned little pin cushion full of pins and needles and such. She pulls one out in front of me and starts to smoke that thing. And it's a needle. And I'm like trying to act like, hey, this is not crazy, but I'm panicking. I'm like, hey, why don't you give me that? I don't think you need that one. And she looks confused. And I said, Joan, it's a pin. You've got a needle. She looks at it, does her head back and forth like a bird or something and says, huh, so it is.
Oh, what?
I'm thinking, okay, this is humorous if it's not my aunt that I love and this is not a nightmare. Right. So I'm like, okay, she's just lost it for whatever reason. She has just like that that stereotypical image you have of one day somebody loses it. You know, they terrify you growing up. Yeah, so-and-so just lost it. You hear these things and I'm thinking, I'm seeing this.
Yeah. Yeah, so you think you're not getting your aunt back.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very scary. And I didn't have anything to go on except she had COVID. And I'm like, that's a virus. What the heck is this? So we end up, you know, she has to get back to the hospital. We're like, something is wrong. So that starts like the onset of a really long thing where I develop a relationship with a caseworker at the hospital. And she said, you know, she should have never been released. This is what's called, and there's like a term for it that they literally mark on paper that someone's released too soon. And so they're brought back and can just kind of pick up where they were instead of going through everything again. You learn a lot about the whole medical process when something like this happens. So they bring her back in and say, okay, she's not able to go home. We were wrong kind of thing. So they're assessing the situation. Again, even though we were this involved and the whole family was involved, we are limited on what we find out. So we don't know what medicines she's receiving. She doesn't have a phone in her room for a while. We're really just kind of held at arm's length and getting like dribbles of the information. Well, they bring a phone in there finally, and we're able to talk. And I get these kind of conversations. I'm looking out my window, and there's a flagpole with a little something on the end of it. And it's like a little cup, and it goes in circles, and it's just the cutest thing. And I'm like, what?
Oh, wow. What?
Yeah. So I told the nurse, I was like, do you realize the kind of thing she's saying? I give the example. Because they say, oh, when we go in, she's just nice. I'm like, ask her some questions. See what you get.
Right. Yeah.
She said, oh, gosh, they're doing work with a crane out there. They're adding on to the hospital, and she can see that from her room. So then I'm realizing, okay, she is seeing something there. Her mind's creating a different story of what that is. And it's almost juvenile. You know, she's got this little cutesy image in her head of what's taking place outside of her room, which doesn't make any sense. So we have days of this. This is an ongoing thing until it gets worse. And then they put her on the floor of the hospital to assess her, which is really sort of the floor where they also think you have lost it. She's in a room that is bare. She's all but strapped down. And she gets worse. So I got to tell you, I would get worse. Like the idea of being held somewhere against my will.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I would get crazy. So while she's there, she can't have visitors for the first so many days. She's through with COVID, they say. Now we can, you know, we can visit because that's why she had went home. But while she's in this place, she can't for like the first, I think it's the first 36 hours or something. Then we can go, and so we all go and take turns going, and her delusions and her have altered. They've gotten worse. They've gotten a little scary, and her state of mind is very, very out there, I guess. A lot of hallucinations, and the recurring one was that there was a man that comes to see her regularly, and we started wondering, is this man real? Because at first it was supposed to be the security guard, but he's visiting with her for time. So I think it was somebody of authority. And that's how her mind put it. Like after the fact, you're trying to make some sense of this. But one thing that kept coming that was so bothersome to us is she claimed there were babies abandoned on the other side of the wall. And that was where the unwanted babies went.
Oh, no.
Yes. And I mean, she cried about the babies. And then the babies were coming down the hall, crawling. And then they were coming through the walls, crawling, crying. And it's like, you're thinking a few weeks ago, she was working in her yard. And so you're thinking, this is what you hear about. She's lost it. This is horrible. This is a nightmare. So they did finally get to a point where they were like, okay, she can go to a regular room. We don't think she's a threat. Because, you know, that's what we were thinking too. Does she know what she's doing?
Right.
So they put her back in the regular room and they don't seem to have any answers. So they said, what you're dealing with, because I had to meet with a caseworker and with the doctor who had watched her, analyzed her during this, you know, stay in this other section. They said what she's dealing with is dementia. And they said, you know, her brain's just struggling. She's got dementia. You know, you're looking at, I said, you're talking about Alzheimer's? And they said, well, maybe, but we're talking about dementia, and dementia can come on for different reasons. And because I'm thinking overnight, you know, what's going on here? And so they tell us, hey, you know, you probably just didn't know. You don't live with her. She probably hid the stuff from you. That she was forgetting. There were probably signs, but you guys just weren't a part of those signs. So then you're going through the whole thing where you felt guilty. Was I not around enough? Should I have? But most people don't go see an aunt on a day-to-day basis. Right. So this is their decision. It escalates to the point where they say, you've got to put her somewhere, or we're going to put her somewhere. I said, well, what do you mean? So they said that that we would have to put her in a home, whether that's assisted living or a nursing home situation. And I said, well, you know, we're not set up. We're not prepared for that. And they said, well, here's the thing. If you don't do that, we can do that on her behalf and you won't have any control over where she goes. So, yeah, that was a bigger, that's actually a bigger story in the fact of what all you have to go through to do that and not knowing what to do. And they said, you know, we can put her somewhere like that was going to be an hour or so away from here and then nobody would be able to visit her. But they can basically file that so that they can be her guardian if they feel like she can't go home. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, not only are you dealing with the emotional side of it and essentially you lost your aunt overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're having to really feel kind of pushed around maybe on how to take care of it moving forward. You don't have a plan for that. Who has a plan for that? You know, just up their sleeve. I can't imagine.
Yeah. And you're not talking about like a parent where you thought in the back of your head, one day I'll have to do something. You're talking about stepping up for somebody's life, for a family member, and making their decisions. And then we find out that we're limited in those decisions because we are not, she hasn't signed off on anything previously. And so that means that either the hospital, they put us in a position, the hospital will file for almost like a custody type thing over her. And, or we have to do that. And that's not power of attorney. That is basically saying, this is something that whether she agrees to it or not, it's signed off on in guardianship. They don't have a say. And that's basically like your kid then for life. You get the, you make all those judgments, you make those calls. So when they start to talking about putting her somewhere where we didn't feel good about, we had her put in an assisted living place that was not far away until we could figure out what to do. Well, that turned out to be a nightmare because assisted living is limited on what the care they can provide. So she was shoved in the dementia Alzheimer's unit there. And she was very confused. She was very confused. So the nightmare continued and visits there. She didn't make sense. She would say things that were sort of paranoid, that were weird. Nothing was like my aunt, except every once in a while, I would see that little bit and I'd think, where are you? Where did you go? And they just, so they told us at that facility that she would be there for life and we might as well accept it and that we were kidding ourselves to think anything else. And that they'd seen this a million times that people were in denial. I said, wow. But she was doing every butt that I had, they'd say, yeah, I know. Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Everybody says this.
Yeah.
So I bought into that finally. What else could I do? I'm like, okay, right. So this is what she has. Well, guess what happened?
Something
happened. She took a fall because she was not getting her medication there because that's not really what they're about. You know, they're not about like care. They're about like upkeep. So she took a fall, ended up by ER back to the hospital. They keep her, deal with the fall situation, which was, I think, a sugar thing, like her blood sugar had dropped.
Sure.
And she starts getting better. She starts, like, what's been going on with me? I don't think I need to be here. And I'm like recognizing some of that normal stuff again. And it's like somebody coming out of a fog. It was the weirdest thing. So she starts kind of bouncing back to her. She goes home. She refuses to go back to that assisted living. They said, we can't make her. You didn't file guardianship. So, because guardianship was going to take a minute. I had to go see a lawyer. It was a whole thing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the other side of this, besides the trauma that she's dealing with, like, you know, you think about with Tiffany and she's experiencing these things firsthand. Somebody has a story that watched her struggle. So coming from that point of view, you're watching somebody struggle. You think you're doing what's right. You think you're understanding is where I was. And they're saying you have no rights before they're pushing me to have rights. So she goes home And we have someone there with her to stay with her. And she just starts getting better. And then she's kind of like, why do I even have these people? Starts asking questions, what happened? Meanwhile, we had made some family decisions, like to sell some things, looking at what we were going to do with our home, because they said, what'll happen in a facility like that? You pay outright or they file for you and your money starts dwindling away. You know, you have to start giving up your resources to pay for the place. Right. So they were like, start with the small. It is expensive. They're like, start with the small things that are not of any consequence. Sell those things. Of course, when she comes to, she's like, where's my stuff? Right. So we're suddenly, you know, appearing to be the bad guys. She doesn't have a clear picture of what happened. And it was pitiful for her because it's like lights out for a while. And like, it was about 3 months total of back and forth to the hospital at the assisted living and then back home. And then she was back herself again. And to wrap all this up, I took her to a neurologist that they sent her to because the hospital she was at does not have a neurologist. They don't have a neurologist in that town even.
Oh, wow.
Right? So I take her out of town to this appointment. He gives a very thorough analysis, says, you never had dementia. She wept like a baby in that office out of relief, out of, you know, the whole, it's still traumatic to her. And I said, what was it? He said, what you had was delirium. Well, I've heard of delirium, didn't have any experience with it. He said, when your body gets out of whack, whether that's by a medication, a trauma, or your system is out of whack, your numbers are off with your, you know, whether that's your sugar, a bad, you know, urinary infection, all these things can cause a state where you are kind of delirious. Her state was longer than some. But he said, I've looked at your scans. We've done our own scans. I've given you verbal tests. I've given you physical tests. That is not what you were dealing with. And he's very clear.
Wow.
Delirium. Yep. Yep. Wow. So she did, I guess, kind of go a little crazy, so to speak. Why that happened, we don't know to this day. It's sort of like a cocktail for bad behavior. You know, we don't know if that was where her body got so sick. She was depleted because we don't know what they, to this day, we don't know what they gave her and what they didn't give her and what her test showed. But she's been back. That was a couple of years ago. You know, that was like, well, it was well over a year ago. And so, you know, I took her again for a checkup recently. Still good. Still good.
So she doesn't remember, you know, she doesn't remember standing on the back porch putting a pen in her mouth.
No, but she can tell the story because she's heard me tell it. And I finally recently gave her back that pin cushion because I took that home with me.
Oh.
I kind of set that aside. I was like, don't eat the pins. And so she knows these stories that we've told her, but they're not true stories to her.
Wow.
And it's just a gap. Yeah. Wow. It's scary.
Yeah. You know, I think that just the suddenness of it and the diagnosis that was not correct. Your aunt's story really reminds me a lot of our guest for next week. And this is Amy Tatro, and Amy is a mutual friend of both of ours.
Right.
And she found herself, I was pretty suddenly sick. And so that's what we're calling that episode. You know, she was given a diagnosis that was shocking. It was unexpected. And I think that we have a lot in store in that episode that kind of goes along with your aunt's story. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, it's definitely one you won't want to miss. And I agree with you. It makes you think of this. So this is perfect tie-in. It was quite the nightmare, but it had the good ending that she is well and she's safe.
I love it. And she's still spunky. She is.
Yes.
Your aunt is fantastic. And yep. So is Amy and Tiffany. So be sure to join us next week. You're not going to want to miss this one.
Well, listen, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, where we post exclusive content, contests, and so much more. And of course, you can keep up with our episodes through Podbean or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And as always, if you have a story that sparks curiosity or you have something that you want us to talk about, just shoot us an email to ourcuriouspodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.